Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, welcome to this week's edition of Terry's Talkin'. I'm David Campbell, sports manager at Cleveland.com, alongside Terry Pluto. As always, Terry, how are you this week?
I am well, David.
Lots going on out there with COVID, and we're seeing it reflected all through Ohio, all through sports teams that Ohioans follow. It's been really crazy. Everybody is healthy and safe in your family, I hope.
Yes, they are.
Good.
So far.
Yeah, us too. We're trying to lay low and see how it goes next few days here with Christmas, and everybody be safe out there. There's a lot going around, as we know. So, Terry, congratulations are in order again. Your new book, Vintage Browns, made a list. You made a list of Esquire's top 100 baseball books of all time a couple weeks ago, and this time Vintage Browns has made a list of the best sports books of 2021 by fansided.com. Congratulations.
I'm really glad. So I'm. It's a nice thing. It's a fun book, and the other wonderful thing has been how I've been getting emails and posts on my Facebook page, et cetera, and Twitter from fans who are reading it, and they just are. It's taking them back to a really fun time, you know, whether it's the Browns of the '80s or even just like a couple of guys of recent vintage of Tim Couch or Phil Dawson or. Aaron Shea is one of those, or going way back, Bill Glass and Ernie Green I put in there too. The Vintage Browns doesn't mean it was the best Browns, just sort of guys that I think illustrated they symbolize a different era of the team, and I thought players that people would like and identify with.
Yeah, and it's fun you have players from different generations too, so yeah. You know, everybody should be able to find something in there. So we can talk more about the book at the end if you want. But hey, speaking of Vintage Browns, Terry,
yes.
It was pretty Vintage Browns the other night on Monday, the way they could pull out. I just made that up on the fly. I did not plan it. But the way they could not pull out that game on Monday night, 16-14, losing to the Raiders. Terry, you wrote about just kind of how gut-wrenching it was for the fans and for the team to go through that after the COVID delay and everything. What were your takeaways from that game?
Well, it's along your gut-wrenching thought. I don't know how many times a Cleveland team has screwed up what I thought while I was writing a really fun, good story. You know,
this
is going to be a great story. Nick Mullins of all people, and he's scrambling around like he's Patrick Mahomes or Fran Tarkenton, whoever you like, and he finds Harrison Bryant wide open in the end zone, and then Greedy Williams picks off the pass. They've got to have this one.
Like Nick Mullins said, it looked like it was going to be a night for Cleveland was the way he put it.
Yeah, Nick Mullins has even fallen into it. Well, welcome to town, Nick. But you saw what happened. But the moment Carr got that ball back again, I'm thinking, even when Chase McLaughlin missed that kick, in the first half, I actually said and mentioned at halftime scribbles, this could really cost them because you could tell it's a low scoring game. And so every point was going to be precious. Extra points were going to be precious in that game.
Absolutely.
And it turns out, I mean, here's the agonizing thing among that game. If you were told, David, before the game, the Browns would A, score more touchdowns than the Raiders, B, the Browns would make no turnovers, do you think they would win?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's what Kevin Stefanski preaches every week is don't turn the ball over and
get a couple touchdowns.
Yeah, and get a couple touchdowns. And that's exactly what they did.
And they actually almost stopped the game and give them the ball. They finally scored a touchdown in the fourth quarter.
Yeah. Yeah. So
well, the second time in 9 games.
Yeah. So like we, you know, we went through this last week. It was a fire hose of news coming out of Berea. Every day there were guys testing positive, mm-hmm. going on the list, who's coming off. And I can't even imagine what it must've been like for the coaches and for Andrew Berea and his staff to try and, you know, they got to find players to fill in for guys who are out. And the 2-day delay, like I thought the Browns, and we talked like for 30 seconds in the press box after the game, but I really give the Browns coaches an A for preparation.
Yes.
Going into that game. And you've been really big on pre-snap penalties and not, you know, not
there
having
was none of that.
There was none of that stuff. And Kevin Stefanski talked last week about Mullins and like, hey, he knows what we do. He knows our shifts. He knows our motions. And that played out perfectly. Like I gave the coaches an A for like pre-game preparation. Everything was tightened up and I'm sure they scaled back, but to not have any of that stuff happen was huge. But I'm giving the coaches a D for maximizing what they had on the field during the game. I thought they could have done a much better job. And I can explain some more about that, but like the thing, there's a way to do it. And you watch the really good teams when they're shorthanded, they find a way to do like conservatively creative stuff, mm-hmm. where they get their best players. Like, you know, you see the Chiefs and they give Tyreek Hill a jet sweep.
Yeah.
And it's an easy play to get Tyreek Hill the ball. And the Browns, it just seemed like they didn't do anything to help themselves the other night. It was like, you know what? We have Nick Chubb. We have 3/5 of our awesome offensive line, and we're going to run into a 9-man box, and we're going to keep running into this 9-man box until we break something. And they just, that was just their attitude the whole night. They made nothing easy for themselves. That was just my take. What do you think of that?
I think they coached scared during the game. By that, I mean, if we'd run these 5 or 6 sets or whatever they're doing, this is, we won't make any turnovers to get to that point. And maybe we could win it ugly. I sense that. And to be fair, Mullins had one practice with the starters Saturday. And even though he has, I always like this mental reps thing, but look, it's like I'm doing mental reps now at my, for my health club, you know, so we're just going to call the, you know, the 15 laps I run on the track plus the 20 minutes on the elliptical. I'm just going to call that done because I could picture myself doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's just which team coached more desperately the other night? The Raiders coached more desperately. They really did.
To your point, though, by the early in the second half, you could see Mullins's confidence growing. And he wasn't even really close to an interception. I don't recall one that like the Raiders dropped or anything. You know, he was either incomplete or on target. And that would have let, you know, if you go back to the 3rd and 3 call that everybody's going to go, you want the ball in Chubb's hands. But I actually was thinking, you know, if they fake it to Chubb, they could just dump a 5-yard pass to Hooper or somebody like that for a first down.
Yeah. And it's easy, right? We're up in the press box and it's easy to second guess this stuff, but it's like, yes, Nick Chubb should have the ball. But like, I just felt like the whole night, and especially on that play, they didn't make it easy on themselves. Like they could have used some different formations to lighten the box. I mean, there were 9 guys in the box. Can you not formation out of a 9-man box?
You also know when you do have Chubb and you've been running the ball, a play action does buy you probably an extra second. Which doesn't sound like much, but when you realize the average NFL quarterback throws a ball in 2.8 seconds, Tom Brady is about 2.2, Baker's about 3. So if you could buy yourself an extra second or so, you're probably going to find somebody for a 5-yard pass, and that's all you needed.
Yeah, yeah, but, you know, but then if there's a drop, we'd be sitting here talking about, like, why can't you give the ball to Nick Chubb?
Exactly.
So I get all that. But
there's always the risk of that.
But it, you know, just – they did not make they did not make things easy for themselves. Right.
And you're correct too. I was kind of wondering if they'd run one of those end around the receivers or something like that, but
even during the course of the game, just to give the Raiders defense something to think
about,
how about some no huddle, like to tire the defense, to tire the Raiders defense out a little bit. There was just, you know, the Raiders ran a fake punt to get a first down. There was just, the Browns did nothing to help themselves. They're just like, hey, this is who we are and we're going to win or lose this way. And I just thought it was a little bit, like you said, they coached tight.
They really coached not to lose. And then in the end of the game too, where I thought for the most part, the cornerbacks were kind of tight on the receivers. they definitely did go into the dreaded, we had a question from one of the readers about the dreaded defense.
The prevent defense. Yep.
Yeah. And it showed up at towards the end of the game.
Yeah. And just, you know, Doug LaMaurice, our colleague, wrote a column earlier this week where he was looking at that third and three play. And I thought he made some really good points. Like, if are you going to run behind Blake Hance and Harrison Bryant on the right side on the last play? Or do you want to run behind Joel Bitonio and David Njoku? Now, Harrison Bryant is like the worst of your blocking tight ends.
Mm-hmm.
David Njoku used to be a not great blocker, but he's turned into a decent blocker. And if, you know, the Browns, who are so big on analytics, I saw this stat and it really struck me. Like on the left, when the Browns ran left the other night, they had 10 carries for 63 yards. When they ran right, they had 4 carries for minus 3 yards.
Yeah.
The Blake Hance's side. So like, again, it's easy to sit up in the press box and critique this stuff. But in terms of like analytics and approach, I was really thrown by it just seemed very un-Browns-like to be running right on that last play, unless they saw something they thought they could exploit. And they're asking their center, J.C. Treader, to make a reach block on Jonathan Hankins, who weighs 335 pounds. And Jonathan Hankins was lined up to the right of J.C. Treader. That is a tough block. I don't know that any center in the league can make that block. So,
and now, to be very fair to the Browns, the effort was extraordinary.
Absolutely.
The willingness to play different positions. I mean, I saw Pro Football Focus gave Joel Bitonio like a left tackle that was like elite.
And he hadn't played the position since college.
Nevada, yeah, he was at Nevada. Because the moment they drafted him, they just put him at guard, and that was the end of it. And then you look at some of those guys in the secondary. I mean, they, you know, MJ Stewart and who else was back there? Greedy. I thought Greedy played pretty well. Mm-hmm. I know that they picked on him a lot, but, you know, I'd rather go at Greedy than I would Denzel Ward if I'm Derek Carr. But Derek Carr can pick you apart. He really can. Derek Carr is a mystery to me. Every time I see him play, I think this guy's like good to really good. And then you look at his career record, he's been the same. He doesn't win games.
He doesn't. I mean, there's been so much dysfunction in that organization.
Yeah,
though, and that's a big part of it. And turnover and coaching changes. And he's had a role with a lot of stuff. But and, you know, you're right. He can look like a world beater some weeks. He can.
Right. But he might be like Ryan Tannehill, too. Remember, Tannehill got out of Miami. He goes to a different system in Tennessee, and he's winning a lot of games. So,
yeah. So
that could be it, too. Yeah. But it's always remarkable to me how the eye test is way beyond what the stats show for Carr. But then you look at some of his like individual stats are pretty good. So anyway, but by the way, do you think, and I would argue this, they win that game with Case Keenum? Forget Baker not playing.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Nothing against Nick Mullins, but just, I think the playbook would have been bigger.
Yes.
And that would have given them a lot more options. And like you're talking about in terms of rollouts and
Baker was really heartbroken, but I tell you, the guy was probably just crushed was Keenum, because he thought, you know, he still wants to play. He's not just there to hold a cookbook and cash a check. And he thought this was, if you listen to his interview, this is, I'm ready, you know?
Yep.
And he's probably looking at the Raiders going, you know, this is like Denver. We can beat these guys. We'll beat them ugly. I'll do what I do. And, you know, I even have Chubb this time. It's just not me and Dearness Johnson. Remember, that's how they beat Denver. And then, bang, that happened. So that was disheartening. I was really, really pleased overall with them. It was discouraging to see that what happened with the ending. But that game could have been a complete disaster with penalties and mistakes and all that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, the preparation was really strong. I just thought there were points of the game where the coaches could have just given them a little push to get them over the top. And I think they were
afraid.
Yeah. Hey, Terry, I want to talk about something real quick that you wrote about earlier this week, the Browns in the fourth quarter and late in games. Your column was about just the struggle that they've had to put games away to score points late. This has been ongoing, and some of the stuff you wrote about really bore that out.
Well, I wanted to look, first of all, the first time I noticed that Hayden Grove, one of our colleagues from Cleveland.com, I think it was after 7 fourth quarters, they had like one touchdown. That's when he first mentioned it. So I started looking at that. And of course, then Nick Mullins actually has one. So then I go back, okay, so that's 2 in 9 games.
touchdowns, total 14 points in 9 fourth quarters. So think about that. That's like two games plus a quarter, 14 points. So that's terrible. I know it's hard to score in the fourth quarter. So then I looked up, well, where do they rank in the NFL scoring? They're at 4 points a game in the fourth quarter. That was 30th out of 32 teams. Then I go back and thought, well, I know there were some games last year, but how were they in the fourth quarter? Well, actually, they were pretty good. They were like 8 points a game, and they were ranked 10th. So it's a big dip when you're talking about close games. And last year, the Browns had 9 games decided by 7 or fewer points. They were 7-2. This year, they just had, that was their 9th game. Same thing, 7 or fewer points. They're 4-5. You know, now the analytics crew always talks about there's a big luck element in that, and it comes back to get you. Maybe. But I'll also say part of winning a game that's close is just like in baseball. Do you shut down the other team in the last couple innings, or do you give up, you know, give up points? And actually, the defense in the fourth quarter has not been that bad. It's not awful. So the problem was they weren't real good in the fourth quarter early in the year, and they've been awful in the last 9 games.
Yeah, and you look, the defense did close the game out against the Ravens, and then they couldn't close it out the other night. And Myles Garrett was getting chipped or double teamed on every play. You talk about baseball. He's your closer. He couldn't make any plays. He is.
And I'm still mad, by the way. We don't do a lot with officials. I thought the call on Wyatt Taylor on Chubb's touchdown run was iffy also.
Yeah, I did too. I was wondering if it was somebody else that they called it on. They got the wrong number because it looked like he had his hands inside on that block. But yeah, you're right. That was a weird one. But they got the touchdown.
Compared to what they're doing, they're doing everything short of like taking the rope from the guys are wearing the headsets and the cord and tying Miles up with it. I mean, it's incredible what they and you know you can see the networks. They're showing the guy. They're grabbing his helmet. And I know it's football and it's a war, but it really is ridiculous. And I know as Miles has finally just stopped talking about it. He's just so frustrated. And the guy's out there playing with a groin pull and everything else. And that's why, to me, I so wanted to write the story as I'm talking right now. And Nick Mullins did it. And something happened on defense. They got the big sack at the end of the game or whatever. And they won 14-13. And was that the most fun game for the Browns you've had in a long time? That's the story I wanted to write.
Yep. It didn't happen. So, all right, Terry, hey, let's look at the AFC North real quick. The Browns could have been in first place if they won the other night. They're now in last, but all is not lost. And our colleague Scott Patsko has been writing about this. The division tiebreakers are in the Browns' favor. They own the tiebreaker against the Bengals because they've beaten them, and the Ravens' division record is 1-3. So if the Browns, if they probably have to win the last two games are more important to their playoff chances than the Packers game, but we'll see how things go. But the Bengals are 8-6, and so are the Ravens. The Steelers are ahead of the Browns at 7-6-1, and of course the Browns at 7-7. But there are a lot of people after the game saying, oh, well, there goes the playoffs. But there's these division tiebreakers. The Browns could get back into it real quick if they win the next two. That could make that last game against Cincinnati real interesting.
Well, Scott had more stats and all that than I did when last Sunday. Because first of all, I didn't even know how the heck to write the Raiders game for the weekend because everybody kept going down. So I just talked about how the last two games would be defining for the team and also for Stefanski and Baker because, they're 2-2 in the division again. You want to see a team have a winning record in the division. And so that's what I wanted to really watch. Cause last year, I believe they were 3-3 in the division because they got beat twice by the Ravens. They split with Pittsburgh and they beat the Bengals twice. So 4-2 would be progress there. I had somebody say to me, he goes, what if the Steelers win this thing?
That would be something.
And, it's like, really? But as I call them, they're like this glob of gum on your shoe. You can't get rid of the Steelers. Even when they had the duck a couple of years ago. Remember, they were actually in contention for the last 2 weeks of the season there. They are just hard to get rid of. But I want the Browns to be that way. I want them to be the glob on Pittsburgh's shoe. Or Cincinnati, where it's like, we can't get rid of these guys.
Yeah, and they're there right now, but you're right, going back to your fourth quarter stuff. It's all about the fourth quarter.
All that. Yeah, all and that has quarter. To do with Baker playing poorly, Kevin having trouble with this play calling. Yes, you know, I've gotten a lot of emails, or they've been missing these offensive linemen and this. That's correct. But you have to also put it in the whole context of the NFL now, where injuries are everywhere, or guys are out everywhere. Well, didn't Kansas City start with five new offensive linemen this year? I believe they did. Because I remember I was just shocking thing when I was in Kansas City for that game, and I was prepping for that game. They got five? Because like Mitchell Schwartz suffered a back injury and, you know, all these other things. And so.
And the good teams find a way. I mean, you'd be hard pressed to find a team that has had more injury problems than the Ravens, including Lamar Jackson, who's been out with, after that tackle by JOK. And they just, you know, they're right in the thick of it as always. So, all right, Terry, it's going to be hard to project what's going to happen in Green Bay, but the Browns, we just found out before we started taping here that they're getting Austin Hooper back off the COVID list today. They just announced that. And Greg Newsome II is not going to be available for Saturday's game. So we'll know more the next couple of days in terms of who can come back. Oh, also, Kevin Stefanski is going to be available to coach.
And by the way, that, you know, when I said a pass to Hooper, I forgot he was out. I actually meant Bryant. It was one of those because he had already caught the TD pass. Remember on the third and three where I wanted to do a play fake and throw to tight end?
Right.
Bryant was the one I was thinking of.
Right.
I figured they probably pay more attention to Njoku, but Bryant, you know, he could do that.
Yeah, and he's got good hands too. So, all right, Terry, let's take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk some Cavaliers, a little bit of Guardians. There's some sale news happening the last few days. We'll talk about your faith column, Waffle House is the theme. We'll do a few Hey Terry questions, and we'll do a quick Terry's trivia. We'll be right back on Terry's Talkin'. Welcome back to Terry's Talking. David Campbell and Terry Pluto back here on the pod. Terry, there's another team obviously having a COVID outbreak, the Cavaliers. They had to postpone their game against the Hawks in Atlanta on Sunday night dealing with COVID. They're 19-12. They're third place in the East. Who would have thought we'd be saying that in late December, huh? And they've won 8 of their last 10. They're playing Boston tonight in Boston, assuming things hold the way they are. So what's your take on the Cavs these days?
Well, I'm not even guess about tonight's game or whatever, but when you're talking 31 games, you're talking almost 40% of your schedule, and you're 7 games over 500. And on top of that, for the first, I think, 25 games, you had the NBA's toughest schedule. So this first half almost has not been a fluke. This team's playing really good basketball. They have an identity with their defensive style, and they move the ball. You know, they had 7 guys averaging in double figures. Nobody's averaging 20. You know, Darius is close. And they're getting a lot out of Love. It's just been wonderful to see that. So I don't think, unless they have cataclysmic injuries or some – and this is the kind of season where almost anything can happen out of nowhere. But it would have to be something coming seemingly out of nowhere, I think, to derail them from – ending up with at least a winning record and making the playoffs.
Yeah. And they've had their share of adversity the last week, especially going into tonight's game. I think, let me see if I can get the list straight here. So Jared Allen is in the COVID protocols, Lamar Stevens, Dylan Windler, Denzel Valentine, RJ Nemhard. And then last week, Evan Mobley and Isaac Okoro were in there. The Cavs going to the Celtics game tonight. The Celtics look like they're going to have Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum. They played the other night, but they're without Al Horford, Grant Williams, Jabari Parker, and guards. I mean, Josh Richardson. Yeah, right? it's like David. The Replacements, that old movie with Keanu Reeves in it something.
And this is like designed by Las Vegas to take people's money.
Something to bet on, right? So I want to ask you.
I mean, like, and you don't even know what you are. You might as well just spin a lottery wheel. I don't gamble at all. But I'm just saying, you just.
Yep.
That's why I've talked the big picture in the Cavs. The specifics for right now, it's who knows. Now, what I've been told about the Cavs situation is that a couple of the guys have sort of mild flu symptoms and the rest are asymptomatic. So it's not as if it's much like the Brown situation. It's not as if these guys are what we hear about with so many people in the hospital and that type of thing.
So speaking of big picture, one thing I wanted to ask you is there's a lot of really good, interesting turnarounds in the NBA this year in terms of coach of the year candidates. I mean, Steve Kerr's got the Warriors playing great again. You know, you look at what's going on in Brooklyn, like, but JB Bickerstaff has to be in the mix and in the conversation for coach of the year, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Because probably the national media isn't aware, but he changed their style of play after their first two games. Yeah, they were doing that more of, we're going to run down and fire up the threes. And they gave up like 130 some points and high 120s. And, you know, this big lineup. And that's why I thought it wasn't going to work, because I thought they're going to play the same, frankly, what I think is a dumb style in the NBA for most teams. They act like they're just as athletic as everybody else. So let's just run and gun and act like everybody else. When you're not that athletic, why are you doing this? So he looked at that and said, no, we're bigger than everybody. And on the run, in practice, he slowed them down. No, we're not going to run as much. We're going to throw our outlet passes. We want layups and that, but we're bigger. Let's just throw the ball over everybody. And you can see as he keeps changing how they get the ball, the big men in different ways with the high-low passing. Absolutely. And the other thing is, he's in year four of a LeBron rebuild. He's had to endure. Remember, he took over for Beeline at the end of the year that was, I think he coached 11 games that year. I think he was 6-5 or 5-6. Then all of last year, and that was another mess. This is a guy, by the way, he's been like an interim coach twice of previous teams. You know, he finally has a place where he is the coach, and this is his team. And the GM, Kobe Altman, gave him some talent. And also, you know, Kobe can't keep going through coaches either. He went, you know, he inherited Tyronn Lue, and then he brought in Larry Drew to replace Lue. Then he brought in Beeline. That didn't work. These guys have to make this marriage work, and they are.
Yeah, and if you're thinking about the national voting for Coach of the Year, I think voters like this kind of a story where JB has changed. He's helped to change the culture. And Chris Fedor, our colleague, wrote about this at the start of the season. You know, he's got these five themes, one more, and they chant one of these five principles every time they break a huddle. I think that is more than just like you got a good bunch of good players and you're winning a lot of games. I think that turnaround thing and that narrative might get him some votes for that award. So we got a long way to go before then, obviously. You know,
a lot of people have slogans, but he put feet to it.
That's a good way to put it.
That's not how you talk, it's how you walk. And so he's been able to do that. Because I remember reading that thing with Chris wrote, which was a really good story with all the slogans, and this early in the season, I'm like, well, that's nice, but we'll see what they get, you know, from that. Well, they got that kind of style. And the roster is really pretty drama three. Now, Kevin Love is bought into coming off the bench. That was the only big question. The rest of these guys, I mean, they're all pretty good guys. Nobody has a head case reputation. So that's why when fans want to start making significant changes on the team, you're out of your mind.
Yeah, it's working. And I'm going to be interested to see, even with guys missing from the lineup, it seems like they want to keep Kevin Love coming off the bench.
Yes.
And not put him into the starters role, even though they're missing some starters. Yeah.
Unless they're like down to six guys. He's. I've been told this from on top. They want him off the bench. They want him between 18 and 22 minutes a game. They fear that if they start playing him more, here comes the injuries again. And also, what they're doing is they're hiding Kevin defensively. And so this way, remember how other teams have put him in a high pick and roll and he's out there chasing some small forward or something, or a shooting guard coming off of that. Well, this way he's primarily out there against the backups. So it isn't as tough on him defensively, and he's killing these guys, you know, on offense. So they want to keep that going. Rubio's a guy they could put in the starting lineup if needed. But they don't want to touch Kevin. It's like you finally have something working with this guy after the last several years. It's not just don't fix what's not even broken. You finally fixed it.
Yeah, and I think if you talk to JB and Kobe Altman, they would say one of the things they're most proud of is that this is all sustainable. Like the way they play is sustainable. Everybody's role is sustainable. This is built for the long haul, and I think that's something that they've really strived to get going here, as you mentioned, in the post-LeBron era. So, all right, the Cavs. Sorry, Terry, go ahead.
With, David, another point. I think it's why a lot of fans have grabbed onto it, depending upon what era you came to the Cavs. I mean, some people identify with the miracle of Richfield in the middle 70s with those guys. Others with the Price, Doherty, Nance group, you know. So that's what's happening here. And those, especially the second group that I covered for the Beacon Journal from 85 through 93, consistent playoff teams just were came in and ranked up running Michael Jordan. But shoot, those are good teams and played it the right way.
All right, so tonight's game Wednesday at Boston, 7:30. Then the Cavs are off till after Christmas. The day after Christmas on Sunday, they're home against Toronto at 6. Then next Tuesday, they're at New Orleans at 8. And then on the 30th, they are going to be at Washington. That's 7 o'clock tip. So hopefully all those games get played. I know the NBA wants to keep the schedule moving, and hopefully the Cavs and everybody can get healthy and keep that moving. So, all right, Terry, let's talk some Guardians. Some news came out this week, and Paul Hoynes, our colleague, has been tracking this. There's news of a potential transfer of some of the ownership of the team to billionaire David Blitzer. He's minority owner of the 76ers, the New Jersey Devils hockey team. He also owns Premier League team interest. I forget which Premier League team, but also he owns the Yankees farm team in Scranton, Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. What do you think of this news of David Blitzer taking over John Sherman's share of the team? And what does this all mean?
Well, interesting thing. A lot of those investments he made with a guy named Josh Harris. They've worked together on the Devils, as you mentioned, the Sixers, the soccer teams. I think Blitzer himself has gone off and like bought the AAA team and baseball Scranton. Curious. They own pieces of, by the way, they also bought 5% of the Steelers last year. So they're buying these little bits. Now, are they positioning themselves somewhere to, now that they are the primary ownership group with Philadelphia, with the Sixers, but are they positioning themselves to become a majority owner in the Indians or the Guardians, excuse me, or will they be content? 35% is a nice chunk. That does position you to get to 51%. Cause I do know that Paul Dolan would have been happy to have John Sherman eventually take over the majority ownership of the team and him stay as a minority owner because they worked together, had good connections. You know, there was a good synergy there. So I don't know Blitzer. It doesn't, you know, he's not a Midwestern guy. He's a Philadelphia guy where Sherman was from Kansas City. So I remember Sherman telling me for 13 months, he and Paul Dolan exchanged emails on their things. They went to dinner a few times, talked on the phone before they finally entered into that thing where he originally bought 15% and went up to 25%. It's back down, by the way, to 15%. People keep reporting, I've written this and people keep reporting 30%. No, it's not it. So this would not only take Sherman's percent or Sherman's 15% out, it also would set up him to, you know, bring more money into the situation. And that doesn't mean the Guardians are going to, suddenly become big spenders. But I believe that this has been now bubbling up for a while. Because remember, Paul Dolan and Antonetti both kept saying they weren't coming back with a $50 million payroll. They weren't going to say what it is, but they certainly indicated what's going up. I heard somewhere in the 75 to 80 range. They didn't say that, but that's what I've been told. So I'm curious. I hope it's the right guy and I hope it comes through, but it looks like this is a deal separate with Blitzer from all these other deals, which are part of this holding company and all these other things. But these are the guys now that buy these franchises. You know, they're usually there's a lot, bunch of partners. Sherman has several partners that bought the Royals with him.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they are safe investments. I mean, if you think about it, you're a billionaire, this is basically a trust, and it's like an antitrust operation.
Classic buy and hold.
And you know it's going to go up. It's like buying one of these NFTs that you know is going to go up, or buying a painting. There's only one Cleveland Guardians. Like, there's never, you know, it's the only one of its kind, and there's a limited number of pro sports teams. So
I remember I wrote the book False Start, and Carmen Policy was a big source for me in that book about how the Browns were bought. He said the at one point the bidding was going on, and Al Werner says, this is getting too high. You know, Werner had the money, but I'm just sick of these guys and all this. And Policy said, he said to him, Al, this is like a Picasso. They're not making any more Picassos. They don't become available, to your point. You buy it now. If not, somebody else is taking your Picasso. This is your chance to get a Picasso in Cleveland. And so then he went and spent the money. But you're correct. And that's why these, I think some of these holding companies and that, even though 5% of the Steelers or whatever, because they probably, if they decide to sell their 5%, they're going to, in 5 or 10 years, they're going to probably double or triple their money there.
Yeah. Yeah. So real quick, before we move on, one of my first reactions was, and I know Paul Dolan has been very strong about making sure the team stays here long-term, yeah, and the new lease runs through 2035 at Progressive Field. If we were to see David Blitzer become majority owner of the team in 5-8 years, is there any, you know, you grew up in Cleveland, you know how important the team has been to the city. Is there any, do you have any reservations or concerns about him maybe moving the team someday? Since it's not, the Dolans have been, they've lived here forever, you know?
Yeah, you always feel more secure with the Dolans than you would with somebody from out of town. But given their vast holdings in so many different areas, a little like Dan Gilbert, you know, Dan Gilbert's got real estate and the mortgage companies, and I don't know how many casinos he still has. He's, you know, he's got all this stuff going on. But once I really looked at all that and I realized he's not going to move the Cavaliers. You know, he told me, he used the word synergy. It's part of the whole package of what we're selling. Well, the Guardians would fit into their whole package of sports and entertainment investment. They're also trying to buy, apparently, the Utah MSL team. That's another thing that's going on there. So, but some of this is with this Harris guy, and some is Blitzer on his own. So they got cash.
Yep, they do. And if we see anything that we learned from the Sherman thing, and Paul Hoynes, our colleague, has written about this, that the Sherman interest did result in a higher payroll, like you were talking about. So they're probably on the field. This influx of money probably would mean a higher payroll, and if history's any guide.
Among those things, I remember writing this story because I talked with Sherman after, this is after they signed Encarnacion. And Sherman told me that was one of the kind of debates that he and Paul Dolan had was, do you really go in for Encarnacion? You know, and I think they spent some money on somebody else that was after the World Series there in 16. And Sherman said, well, you know, I made my money in natural gas, and you have to be willing to sometimes drill in different places. Not every place you drill comes up with a gusher. And so it was the same thing here. This guy's been willing to Blitzer to invest across the board in entertainment and sports properties. So he doesn't have to be a sniper. You know, he could be a little bit of a machine gun guy, take his shots here, shots there, shot without. And I think that might be a little bit of a mentality he may bring in. Well, let's try this. I'm not saying we give somebody a 10-year contract, but let's go a little deeper.
Yeah, there's so much we don't know about what the 2022 Guardians season is going to look like between this and the labor agreement. So there's a lot to be written there. So, all right, Terry, let's talk about your faith column. Christmas is this weekend, obviously. And I thought you had a charming column this week about you and your father and a Christmas that you spent at the Waffle House. I just was wondering if you could talk about that real quick and share kind of what that meant.
Yeah, I was just thinking about different Christmases in the past. And this was back when I was going down to Florida, Sarasota all the time. My dad had his stroke. And one of the things that I remember was Christmas Day. We went to like my brother's house for something in the morning. And then it's like early evening. And my dad is hungry, and I'm starting to cook something, and he wants to go out. My father couldn't speak. All I could say was man after a stroke. He's like pointing to the door, and he's pointing to his mouth. I'm like, you want to go out to eat? He's nodding. And I'm like, okay. And I'm thinking, what's open? It's Christmas. Waffle House. So we go to Waffle House. And I'm kind of curious. It was by a hospital in Sarasota. I'm like, well, I wonder who else is going to be in there. And there was like, nobody else was in a group. Everybody was like sat out there. And I remember there was a waitress and she just looked exhausted. And the cook behind the counter was this guy. I mean, I've been around jailhouse tats, the whole thing. My father, rolled my father in. And, you know, the waitress just brightened up when she saw us roll up. And a couple of people said hello. And my father, by the way, liked Waffle House too, for another reason. Unfortunately, with losing his ability to speak, he lost his ability to read. So the menus had the pictures of the different. So he could, instead of me ordering, you know, he just was pointing at, he got a waffle and he got bacon and eggs and something. And we had a great time at the Waffle House. And it just reminded me, it's kind of like how Jesus and Mary, you know, they go wandering into Bethlehem. There's no room at the inn, as they say. They end up in the stable. Some shepherds show up. Welcome to the first Christmas. Well, it's kind of like if there had been a Waffle House back in Bethlehem 2,000 years ago, they might have wandered into there to get something to eat.
Yeah, it's you always think of Christmas and the plum pudding and the turkey and the ham and the fancy huge table and some of the, that was just a wonderful Christmas moment that like was the exact opposite of the typical American Christmas scene. And
that strike me. And the first Christmas wasn't typical of that. And the other thing that I knew was going on with a couple of the people, because you're next to the hospital and it's late at night, I'm sure some of them were on that duty. You know, somebody's in ICU and where you get to stay for 10 or 15 minutes with them. Then you wait 2 hours, you get another 10 or 15 minutes. Well, let's go to the Awful House. Well, the Awful House, if some people would go up at the Waffle House and see what we could get.
Some of the most wonderful Christmas memories come from very unexpected places. There's no doubt about that. So, all right, Terry, we got some Hey Terry questions this week from readers. You can hit us with a question by emailing sports@cleveland.com and put Hey Terry or Terry's Talking in the subject line. Or if you want to hit Terry up on his Facebook page, that's a good place to hit him too. Terry, you put a picture of Phil Dawson. Boy, you had to rub it in on Browns fans, didn't you, after the missed kick the other night? So this is what people had to say about your solicitation for questions. Since we were talking about Phil Dawson, Paul Taylor was on Facebook and he says, "Hey Terry, how many kickers have the Browns had since Phil Dawson?" Well, I did not know the answer to this.
He was let go at the end of 2012 by Joe Banner. He kicked for seven more years after that, I may add. And that was just a silly move on Banner's part. The answer is eight, unless I miscounted. And they've had Cody Parkey twice. They've had nobody for two consecutive years. And probably they're going to have somebody real soon. If not this season, then next. By the way, trying to find a kicker right now, I mean, I guess you could, but, man, I don't know who that would be. It's not like Colquitt, you know, who had just been released a few weeks earlier by Kansas City. And by the way, I see they let go of Jamie Gillis and let Colquitt do the punting. Jamie Gillen, yeah. And they're going to let Colquitt do the punting for the rest of the year. Because, you know, he had been punting for a fair amount of time. He wasn't out that long. And secondly, he'd been doing it forever. I don't know if there's a kicker out there like that. If there were, I want to see him, by the way.
Yeah, we need the place kicking family equivalent of the Colquitts. To send the Browns somebody to help
that
them.
Is that is interesting, so that you do get some of those things, but you don't get kicking families.
All right. Hey, Terry, this question
Justin is Tucker's brother. Can he kick?
Put out a call. So, all right, Terry, this one is from John Stark. He says, "Hey, Terry, what is Phil Dawson doing now?"
I can't think of the name of the school. It's a Christian Academy in Nashville. And Phil's son, Bo, plays on that team. And the coach is Trent Dilfer. And Phil is like I don't know if he's defensive coordinator or
special teams, I think, if I remember. Special teams coordinator.
I think he's coordinating something else too. So they're down there together doing that.
All right. We got a Browns question from Bruce Jeffrion. I wonder if he's related to Boom Boom Jeffrion, the old great hockey player. He says, "Hey, Terry, when are the Browns going to go for the win and stop playing prevent defense?"
Well, it wasn't Monday. You know, your coordinator has to decide, I have good enough people in the secondary to do that. And I actually think when the Browns are healthy, when they have Newsom and they have Denzel and they have Greedy and you have John Johnson and you have Harrison and you have Delpit, You know, those guys, and you, well,
and Hill
as a linebacker, he could cover. You can be more aggressive. And I thought they could have been more aggressive in that, but it is something that kind of, when a team needs a touchdown to win, making a prevent defense makes a lot more sense to me than when they only need a field goal. Because if you just keep giving up those chunk plays, you're setting it up for that. And you also could play your safety somewhat deeper, but you could still keep your cornerbacks up on the receivers.
Yeah, you could. I'm always blown away too watching Hail Marys at the end of a game. It's like you hold a team down for 59 minutes and 50 seconds, and you're going to give them a Hail Mary. You're going to rush three and drop eight and let the quarterback stand back there.
And line them all up at the goal line.
Yeah, it's like you basically turn the game into a 50-50 proposition. Like, is our guy going to catch it or is their guy going to catch it? If I would send three rushers and I would send two corner blitzes coming full bore from the outside and just take away that time. If you give a guy a second and a half to throw on a Hail Mary, there ain't going to be no Hail Mary. Like,
well, David, too. But
I
want to make sure I got the rule right. But if you know, like, they have one or two fast guys, can't you put a cornerback right up in their face and fight them for the first 5 yards off the line of scrimmage?
Absolutely.
Just to slow all that down?
Yeah, instead of letting it release.
Like the gun goes off and this is the 50-yard dash. Go, guys.
Yeah, meet you in the end zone. We'll see who catches the ball. So, anyway, that's a little pet peeve of mine. So, we'll see what happens this weekend.
Sort of like there's going to be
some Hail Mary that'll happen. It'll make me look like I didn't know what I was talking about. So, all right, Terry, we got a Cavs question from Matt Coso. He says, hey, Terry, can the Cavs' big three front line be better than Daugherty, Nance, and Hot Rod?
That's interesting, because if you think about Daugherty was 20 when he came to the NBA, because he graduated from high school at 16, but he played 4 years. Hot Rod was 23. Nance played a four-year player at Clemson, then played with Phoenix. Were these guys, when you look at Mobley is 20 or 21, I forgot which, Jared Allen is 23, Markin is 24. You know, my first thing to say no, because I covered those guys, how good they were. But these guys with the Cavaliers, Markkanen, Allen, and Mobley are still so young. And in general, big guys do develop later. So that's a definite maybe. How's that?
Yeah, we might have to track this. It would be a good story sometime.
It really would be to compare statistical analysis at the different stages of their career.
Yeah. Great question. Thanks for sending that in. And finally, our last one from our loyal listener, Kathleen Thompson. She says, hey, Terry, Jetty Osmond has played great this season. Do you think he can continue to play this way?
Well, I never thought he'd play this way in the first place. And that was another guy I would have been wrong about. If somebody wanted him, I'd have given him away too, along with other bad moves I was ready to make at the end of last year, like buying out Love. Maybe because he's very comfortable. He's not playing against starters. Remember, we talked about Love. We've concentrated on Rubio and Love coming off the bench, but Osmond's a big part of that too. And these are experienced players. You could just tell Chetty sometimes gets too wound up and he goes crashing into three guys or, you know, fires up a 30-footer. But the energy is there. He definitely has improved his shot. Sure. Can he continue to give them 11 to 14 points a game off the bench? Yeah, and they're going to need them too, because, you know, they're going to have injuries and COVID and everything else. But we're also talking 31 games now. It's not three games. It's not 13 games. So he's put together, like the team, a pretty good track record so far this season.
Yeah. And it's funny, Jared Allen talked about while he was waiting for his big contract to come through, he was putting money in the bank with his game over the summer, like working on stuff. I got a feeling Jetty was doing the same thing. Like he looks a little lighter to me too. Does he look that way to you? Like
he is.
Yeah.
And the thing that Allen's exact quote I love is he goes, I looked at it like putting pennies in the piggy bank. That's what he said. That sounds like Grandma Allen must have drill that into him. When you practice, it's putting pennies in the piggy bank, but that's what he said.
Yep. I think Jetty's got a few in there too, so the way he's playing. So, all right, you ready for a Terry's trivia question? You probably know the answer to this one too. So, all right, we've been talking a lot about Phil Dawson today, Terry. What is Phil Dawson's middle name? I did not know this one.
No clue. It ain't Lou Groza.
It's not. It's Drury. Philip Drury Dawson. D-R-U-R-Y. That's a very...
Must be a family name.
Yeah, it must be. I like to find out the story about that sometimes. So anyway, I just thought that was kind of interesting. Terry, we talked about Vintage Browns earlier. People can get it online, and also you've done a lot of signing of copies. I know you want to do a lot of signed copies. There's still time to get
one. I would call the stores first just to make sure, and then because they have been moving really well. But I left at all four Barnes and Nobles in the Cleveland area. That's Mentor, and that's Crocker Park, and that's Woodmere, and that's Fairlawn, and also at Learned Owl Bookstore in Hudson. But do call first because they have been selling. But I have signed over 2,000 books.
Left of How's your hand?
Or there. My hand loves this type of pain because it means money.
Putting pennies in the piggy bank, right?
Pennies in the piggy bank.
All right. So there's still time to get that if you want it for a stocking stuffer, Vintage Browns, Terry's new book. Terry, thanks for making time this week. I just want to wish you and Roberta a Merry Christmas. I know you have some plans this weekend in addition to watching the Browns game. So always a special day, and I hope you guys enjoy it.
Yes, looking forward to it.
Awesome. And everybody, listen, be safe out there. There's a lot of COVID going on, as we all know. Please take precautions to keep you and yours safe. Have a Merry Christmas, and we'll see you all next week. Terry's talking.